Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's a lot at stake for the European Union when it comes to the development of the Indo-Pacific region because we are an important stakeholder. So security is a key factor here and we have a lot to bring to this region.
What's happening in Ukraine is exactly one of the reasons for which it's so important to have a collective approach in this region.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. Brought to you by the ANU National Security College with support from policyforum.net. In this episode, the EU and French ambassadors to Australia join Professor Rory Medcalf to discuss the EU strategy for cooperation in the Indo-Pacific ahead of the EU Indo-Pacific Forum, which will be hosted by the ANU National Security College on the 25th of May. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging.
Welcome back to the National Security Podcast. This is a very special episode where we're going to look very closely at the way Europe is engaging with the strategic challenges and opportunities of the Indo-Pacific region. And in particular, we're going to focus on the EU Indo-Pacific strategy released in 2021, but very much a priority of the EU presidency with France in the chair for the first half of 2022, and indeed moving forward throughout this year. So it's a real pleasure to welcome to the studio here at ANU the ambassadors of the European Union here in Canberra, Ambassador Michael Pulch, and also the ambassador of France, Jean-Pierre Thibault, who's here representing France in the EU chair position. It's great to welcome you both to the studio.
Good morning, Rory.
Yes, pleasure to be here.
So there are so many things from a regional perspective, including from an Australian perspective, we could discuss about why is Europe so engaged in the Indo-Pacific? What are Europe's equities here? But I thought I'd begin with that framing question. Why does this region matter to Europe? Why does it matter to the EU? I'll go to you first, Michael.
Thanks, Roy, for that question. And there's a lot at stake for the European Union when it comes to the development of the Indo-Pacific region because we are an important stakeholder. We are invested in this part of the world, and that is quite literally. The EU investment stock is 12 trillion euros. That is much higher than any other partner of the Indo-Pacific, be it the US, China, or Japan as an investor. We are also opening up our market as one of the world's largest consumer market to products from this region, and therefore we are the second largest trading partner. So together with investment and trade, we are a part of the economic fabric of this part of the world, of the Indo-Pacific. We create jobs and employment and economic stability. But we do more. We are also one of the key development partners for many of the Asian countries here. And we bring our concept of peace, stability, and values to this region, which we believe is important for the prosperity of the next generation of Europeans as well as those living in the region itself.
That's a very useful articulation, particularly of the economic and developmental side. But I might just press you a little bit further on the strategic and security side of the equation, because many of us looking from Australia look, for example, at the impact of Chinese power on the region, the many potential flashpoints, the risks and realities of coercion and so forth. and wonder about the future security in this region. So I might ask you, just staying with you for a moment, Ambassador Pulich, I might ask you, how does that side matter to Europe? And then I'd be interested also then in hearing of you from Ambassador Tebow.
Yeah, it matters a great deal. As we've seen at the Ministerial Forum on the Indo-Pacific that was held in Paris, there were three vectors of our interest. Security and defense was one of them. Connectivity and digitalization was the second. And the third was global challenges with health and climate change and environment. So security is a key factor here, and we have a lot to bring to this region. Just think about what we've already done. 10 years ago, trade between Asia and Europe was threatened by piracy around Somalia and the coast of East Africa and Western Indian Ocean. We've dealt with that with an initiative called Operation Atalanta, and secured trade links continuing between both areas. Now we are facing a conflict in Europe, military aggression by Russia against Ukraine. And amongst the key partners that we have in that core group of like-minded countries are quite a number of Asian partners. Think about Japan, South Korea, Singapore, but also, of course, Australia.
So turning to you, Ambassador Tebow, it would be interesting to hear your perspective both from an EU and indeed specifically from a French perspective as well on why the Indo-Pacific matters.
First, it matters because we are stakeholders here. We have populations. Just for the French, we have 2 million citizens in the Indo-Pacific. Those citizens, we care about them and we care about their possibilities in the future, their safety, obviously, but also their development. And we want them and the territories where France is present in the Pacific to enjoy a peaceful, open, a rule-based Indo-Pacific. But it's not only French. You know, when you look at the Indo-Pacific in general, you have millions of EU citizens being part of the fabric of the area. The second thing is we acknowledge also that major future challenges are in this region. You mentioned the one on security, but let's speak about climate change. Climate change is a major element of security for the future. And at the same time, the Indo-Pacific is the place where those challenges are rising faster than anywhere else. Just look at the emissions of CO2. You know, the amount of internationally produced emissions of CO2 have almost doubled in the Indo-Pacific since 2000. And it's over 50% now of the global emissions in the world. But it's also the place where the remedies for these climate change threats are more, probably more than anywhere else, more relevant. Think about those hundreds of millions of citizens in the Pacific, which are exposed to the consequences like sea rise levels, but also pollutions and also land threats of the climate change. It matters here for the stability of the regions that we here tackle both the challenges, but also that we implement the solutions. So this is another very important element of the EU strategy. And last but not least, it's also self-interest. Obviously, our trade here that we want to push and develop, which is an element of stability, of balanced development, is now in majority here in this region. And we want, together with the actors and partners in the region, to further develop it, but also to protect it. So a bunch of very good pragmatic reasons for the EU to be interested in the Pacific and to continue to be interested in the Indo-Pacific and to be willing to become, together with the partners in the region, an integral element of the fabric of the region.
So you've touched already, I think, on the strategy, this major blueprint that was issued last year. And of course, I think it's very telling of the times that not only the EU, but a number of other players in the region have outlined very clear, if you like, plans to deal with or to address the problems of the region and to look through an Indo-Pacific lens, to look at that integrated two-ocean system as their frame of reference. But why this strategy, I guess, is my question. What is the strategy setting out to achieve? What are the objectives of the strategy? And how are you going to measure success? I might go back to you on that first, Michael.
Well, as we pointed out in our answers, we can only achieve a number of the objectives for European development if we work together closely with the Indo-Pacific. And that is, I think, at the outset of the strategy that we've devised. And therefore, we have a whole range of objectives that we want to bring into that debate. And it is not only the strategy, Indo-Pacific strategy itself, but it is also enabled by a number of others that are around that. For instance, Global Gateway, a new initiative that we set up to create more connectivity and infrastructure between Asia and Europe and between Asian countries, to respond a bit to similar infrastructure programs and connectivity programs by other Asian countries. We also have a strategic compass that we adopted recently, and that sets out our strategic vision of the world for a 5 to 10 years period and how we as Europeans want to respond to that. So we have intertwined, if you wish, our future and our vision for a peaceful, stable and secure future of the world between Europe and the Indo-Pacific. And that is a bit what is at the core of our Indo-Pacific strategy. Now, how do we measure success? We will measure it, I believe, by the way that we are creating these kind of new webs or intensify the existing network of connections with the region. And there are very concrete examples, whether we have a civil aviation agreement with ASEAN, whether we have an initiative of bringing together Asian and European countries to work on issues like terrorism and non-proliferation and organized crimes, whether there are initiatives to draw European youth and Asian youth together in a Erasmus program that allows for an exchange, or whether it is a Horizon Europe on scientific cooperation. There is a lot that we can bring to that region. And let me just talk about the pandemic for a moment. The entire vaccination program here in Australia was based on a vaccine developed in Europe, in Mainz, by a company called BioNTech, and produced in Europe and shipped to Australia. A very clear example of what we can achieve when we are working together.
Ambassador Tebow, I might build on that with you for a moment and ask about whether to what extent is the strategy essentially an aggregation of national approaches of the many different Europe or many varying European national approaches, or whether it's something larger that potentially lifts other European powers to the level of engagement in the region that for example, France has already demonstrated?
Definitely, it's larger. First, Europe didn't wait it to be interested by what's happening in the Indo-Pacific. As back as 1996, when we created ASEM, it was the initiative then of President Chirac and Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew. This was a clear signal that we considered that we had stakes here in the region. And this has developed over the years.
And just to clarify, ASEM is it's Asia-Europe.
It is the Asia-Europe meeting, which became an annual leaders meeting. So, you know, the strategy is being developed, in fact, since over 20 years. After that, there is what Michael said. You know, it's quite eloquent. 12 trillion of euros of investments in the Indo-Pacific, the largest and twice bigger than the one of the US, seven times bigger than the one of China. We are stakeholders here. And the size of the trade. But last but not least, I think that what is important is that at the same time, there has been, and you're right, a realization that we needed something structured. We needed something that anticipates the changes and not only that does provide, fora or possibilities for discussion when things do happen. And this is the change. Yes, it has been initiated within Europe with France adopting an Indo-Pacific strategy. President Macron outlined this strategy when he had a state visit in Sydney in Australia in 2018. And we are very happy that together with our colleagues, EU partners, together with the EU Commission, we were able to develop further on that, first on some national Indo-Pacific strategies, and now on an aggregated, full-strength, full-developed EU Indo-Pacific strategy. This is a game changer. And Michael was right in stressing it on the outset. You know, this clearly proves that the EU has a long-term planning, a long-term vision of the region, not only because it is in its self-interest, because what's happened also here in the region matters for us, for our stability, for our security, for our prosperity. We don't want any Indo-Pacific. We want an Indo-Pacific which is a partner, which is a partner with whom we build things, and we build those things in the interest of the population of both Europe and the Indo-Pacific. And for that, we need projects. So that's the reason for which Michael mentioned the Global Gateways Project. You know, it's 300 billion of euro, half a trillion Australian dollar, to be spent on infrastructures up to 2027, you know, in just 5 years' time. It's a huge investment program. It's Team Europe making it, meaning the EU and all its member states. And I think this is a part of the game changing.
And one observation I would make here, we might come back to this later on, is that apart from anything else, this would appear to give countries in this region options. It would give countries in this region choices so that when, for example, we're looking at the question of infrastructure and development, it's not simply do you go all the way with the Belt and Road, or do you insist that you have nothing to do with Chinese infrastructure and somehow go all the way with the United States? It seems to be that you're expanding the range of choices that countries in this region have
correct
for their development.
That's correct. And there is another element as well. We want to be a benchmark for a successful infrastructure program, because we emphasize transparency, we emphasize stakeholders' cooperation, we emphasize good government and governance in these programs. And I think that in itself is also a change of the way that a lot of these programs have been run in the past when we introduced that. On top of that, we would like to also emphasize our green ambition that we have with these programs, so that they also lead to a world that has more focus on climate change policy.
So it's sustainable in every sense, environmental, but also political and economic. But I'm going to go to a challenging question on the tensions globally and the tensions in Europe, where or not just tensions, but the outright conflict, in fact, that we've witnessed in Ukraine. We're recording this in April 2022, and of course we've seen for some time now this really the outrage of the Russian aggression against Ukraine, the violence there, and the impact that that conflict has had on the European security outlook. And so the pressing question for you on the Indo-Pacific, and I'll actually go to you first, Jean-Pierre, if I may, and then to Michael, is how does the EU balance its interests in the Indo-Pacific against its interests in Europe? Will, for example, the challenges arising from Russia's invasion of Ukraine undermine the strength of the EU's commitment to the Indo-Pacific?
As the contrary. You know, first, I would absolutely challenge the idea that Ukraine is a European question, European only. It is European question, obviously, but not only. What is at stake in Ukraine, you know, is the values on which the international order is being based. It's the values of national sovereignty, territorial integrity, but also, you know, refusal of violence as a mean to solve disputes. And this is what's happening in Ukraine needs to be opposed. And we are very happy that the world opposed it. You know, over 140 countries, you know, regularly have voted resolution in the UN against, you know, the Russian aggression. We are very happy, obviously, that, you know, a lot of stakeholders here in the Pacific have joined also, despite maybe being geographically distant, but being in fact very aware of what is at stake. What happens in Ukraine, if let unnoticed, if let happening, is something that could happen next in this region. So it's not the other side of the world. It's a part of the same world. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, symbolically, the Paris Indo-Pacific Conference, which has been the first of its kind after the adoption of the strategy, has taken place on the 22nd of February, at a time where the tensions were obvious, the risks were obvious in Ukraine. And we decided, the presidency, France, together with the EU, that we should keep it despite the odds. And there were 60, you know, countries represented at ministers level of secretary generals of international organizations, which means that this is also a very important subject. And we symbolically wanted this to take place so that the decisions that Michael mentioned, these big decisions with a lot of money attached and with a lot of political power attached to it, would be announced in the way we wanted to announce them. And last but not least, we think that more than ever, the challenges that are here in these regions are core for the future safety, stability, including of Europe, for the world. We think that contributing effectively, strongly in having a rule-based order, in demonstrating that there are choices, exactly what Michael said, choices in terms of models, choices in terms of how you invest, choices in who are your allies, choices among your values is extremely important. And it is time for Europe to play its full role in the Indo-Pacific. It is already an unknown major player in the Indo-Pacific. It must now make a use of its presence, make a use of its possibilities of influence, but also in partnership to contribute, shape the future face of the Indo-Pacific. So I would say that what's happening in Ukraine is exactly one of the reasons for which it's so important to have a collective approach in this region. And I insist on the aspect of collective. It cannot be unilateral. And the EU wants it because the EU wants to be a sovereign partner, but also a respected and influential partner worldwide. This is the motto of the French presidency of the EU currently, you know, enlarging, strengthening the sovereign possibilities for the EU to be a globally respected and very much involved partner. Those are nice speeches. We will be judged at our actions, I know, and it's good because we are pragmatic people also, and we will make the difference and contribute with all like-minded countries to make the difference.
Thank you for that. And I'm glad that you've emphasized the global character of the challenge to order and to values that we've seen in Ukraine. Ambassador Pulch, what do you think?
Well, what I believe is we have seen already the synergy effects of the European policy reacting to what is happening at its doorsteps in Ukraine directly, but also working with partners around the world, with our transatlantic partners, with whom we have a very intensive cooperation for decades already on security matters as member of NATO, of many European member states, but also here with Indo-Pacific partners. I believe in the run-up of the conflict, we've seen this very clearly by having the Munich Security Conference back-to-back with the Ministerial Forum on the Indo-Pacific, which allowed many countries such as Foreign Minister Payne to attend both of these events. So that discussion brought back to our partners here in this region that this is not something that is far away. This is an issue that it threatens the global order on which also stability in the Indo-Pacific region is based. And it shows to the European population how important the Indo-Pacific strategy is for our own security, because we get support from our countries from that region, and we get it because they understand that we are on the same side when it comes to values, when it comes to a vision for the future of this globe. And therefore, I believe the synergy effects will be a driving factor of making our Indo-Pacific policy a priority for the future.
So I'm glad you've mentioned the Paris Ministerial Forum in particular. We may come back to that in a moment, but Ambassador Thébault, you had a point you, I think, wished to add.
Just to stress two things, which I think, because you mentioned, you know, there were other Indo-Pacific strategies all over the world. It's true, but ours, I think, has two very important specificities. Beyond the fact that it's rule-based and it wants to have a level playing field, it's geographical dimension, you know. For us, the Indo-Pacific strategy, and it's important for the future, does encompass from Eastern Africa to the Pacific Island countries. It's a complex, diverse, but very interconnected area, and this is important. This is the scope of our ambition. And the second thing is, we put climate change and climate change consequences at the core of it. Michael stressed it very much. You know, climate change is a future security threat also for the region, and we need to address it as a huge element, central element. And you here in Australia, you know this, you know, you have the calls of the Pacific Island countries, of many other countries, large or smaller. This is a key element on which we must definitely make progress. And the EU, which is a strong, you know, actor on the international scene of an efficient action in this respect, wants together with the partners here to try to tackle this issue. Without climate change policy, we won't tackle what is a major threat for the planet and for the region.
Yeah, I think there's no question that this region is an epicenter of those challenges. And I'm glad you've mentioned other Indo-Pacific strategies, because one of the questions I think that many observers have of the strategic picture is how the national and collective approaches of different players, different nations or different groupings, how these overlap, perhaps how they differ as well. So, for example, we've got the so-called free and open Indo-Pacific strategy that Japan and the United States in their own ways have advocated. We've got Australia's own very active role as a power in framing the region as the Indo-Pacific and using that as a basis for strategy. We've got India's approach. We've got the ASEAN outlook on the Indo-Pacific. It's becoming quite a crowded space, and that's good. That's healthy, I think. But the big question is, what do you see as the convergence, the overlap, or in some cases, the differences among these approaches? I'll go to you first, Ambassador Pulch.
Thank you, Rory. Well, first of all, I believe that convergence and overlap is probably what defines the various strategies or visions. Sometimes they're also called differently, that we've seen emanating now from more and more countries directly or partners in the region. If you think about how fast the development was on the European side, Jean-Pierre mentioned quite rightly that France was the first member state to come out with a vision for this region. And shortly afterwards were two more member states, Germany and Netherlands. And only 3 years later, we expanded that to the entire European continent by having an EU vision for this region. So largely, there is a convergent and an overlap in what we want to achieve with our partners. Our platform allows to enable our various webs of contacts that we have bilaterally and multilaterally with partners in the region. So we don't replace that. We just incorporate this into our broader outlook. And I think that's an important aspect. There are some differences as well. Geographical description of the region is one. The emphasis, of course, changes a bit, whether you are in the South Pacific part, whether you are an ASEAN country, whether you are India, or whether you are Europe. What I think is encouraging for us is that since we have based it on quite successful long-standing policies that we already had, we've seen in the direction of our partners a lot of positive feedback, and so we are encouraged by that reaction and see that the countries actually would like the EU to be part of this region, which is important. We are accepted and we are wanted. But also that I think the way we've defined our contribution is the one that also countries would like us to be present.
So just to emphasize there, you would focus on the broad convergence or consistencies among these different visions, whether it's the EU and ASEAN or whether it's the EU and potentially the United States, Japan, Australia and others. Is that reasonable?
I think that is the approach that we're taking. After all, we want to have a consensual moving forward as much as we can. And obviously, you would like to start with those parts where we are already successfully cooperating and creating this web of confident cooperation and the type of interaction and that has brought us to this new strategy.
Ambassador Tebow?
We obviously want to have an efficient action. If we want to be seen as relevant, we need to build on communalities. As Mike mentioned, the first element, however, on which we will judge our possibility to engage or not, will be rule-based order, will be democracy and choice. The second thing which I think is important, at least for the EU, is the centrality of ASEAN. This is a very important notion and a notion on which our strategy has been based officially and strongly. I remember ASEM in 96, since the start, Europe has been willing and is still engaging very actively with ASEAN, and this is a core partner for whatever we will do here. But at the end of the day, partnerships, like-mindedness will be the key. We are bringing here all the elements we've mentioned, our rank in terms of trade, investment, largest, development aid provider in the whole region. These new additional funds we are bringing, half a trillion Australian dollar on communication, etc. The more will be possibilities to have like-minded partners being ready to leverage together with us, or us being able to leverage some projects from partners in the regions, the better. What we want is to have an active conversation here and a global understanding and overview of the region and so opportunities to engage. So it's an open end by the EU, by the member states of the EU in their capacity as member states, but as capacity as stakeholders of the EU to be present here. And that's the reason of this forum we together with ANU do organize on the 25th of May. To make more people being aware, not only about the existence of this strategy, but of why it matters and why it is a substantial offer of cooperation and of opportunities. It's unseen. And as you mentioned, what is happening in the world, the way the world is being shaken by ambitions and sometimes brutal actions, is a wake-up call that we need more than ever such kind of strategies.
We'll be right back.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
As we turn to defining the principles that underscore the European engagement with the region, and I'm glad you pointed to some of those Jean-Pierre, the principles such as rules-based order and respect for international law and so forth, and certainly the focus on sovereignty. I think we can find a thread that runs through many of the Indo-Pacific visions, some of them manifest in strategies with resourcing and objectives and so forth. We also find something of a challenge, though, which I'll come back to at the end of the conversation, and that challenge, I think, is going to be about how all of the various Indo-Pacific approaches contend with the role of China in the region. So I will park that for a moment, but I want to come back to it because I think it really is key. Key for us also, and recording this from Australia and having worked a lot on Australia's own vision of the Indo-Pacific over the years, I would say is the role of Australia in this region. And so I'd be very interested in hearing from you both how the EU strategy envisages the role of Australia in the Indo-Pacific. I'll go to you first, Michael.
Thanks, Roy, for your question. And for me, as an EU ambassador to Australia, the Indo-Pacific strategy clearly defined the role of Australia much better than what we had in the past when we spoke about this region as Asia-Pacific. And on Asia-Pacific, it was forever unclear where were the boundaries. Was Australia and New Zealand included, or the Pacific Islands included in these strategies or not? And now we are clear. It is the Indian Ocean, it is the Pacific Ocean, and Australia is right in the middle of both. And therefore, even geographically, you can see the centrality of Australia in that part. And it comes at a moment where like-mindedness and the working together between countries with the same value and democracy-based constitution has become so important, and that gives us an anchor here. I'm therefore very pleased that we now have a strategy that defines clearly who is part of that and how we see the grouping of our partners globally. And therefore, I believe Australia will play a very important part of it. We want to upgrade our relations with Australia. That is the vision that we've put forward. It is a good sign that Foreign Minister Payne attended the First Ministerial Forum in Paris right at the outset.
Ambassador Tibbo, what do you say?
I would say that we are happy that Australia is willing to be part of it. But there is no surprise, I think. I can say that since the onset and since the visit of President Macron here in Australia in 2018, when he outlined our French strategy, if he did come to Australia and made it in Australia, it was a sure sign, and he said it, that he thought and considered that for France, Australia was the core of an Indo-Pacific strategy. So, there is no need to elaborate on that. We have proven, the proof is in the pudding, and so we've proven our commitment in this. And the fact that it's a shared view by the EU is important also. But as it is a regional strategy, what is important is not only to focus to one or the other country. It is important that we constantly look at the transversal approach. Like-mindedness, I mentioned, is a key element of a successful strategy. We can succeed in being, very happy among us, a very limited number of countries, of the fact that we think the same. The success in the region, because it's a success that does matter not only for the whole region, but also for the world, is enabling a broader engagement. So the key element in the EU Indo-Pacific strategy is insisting on this like-mindedness and having an open hand and inclusive approach to whatever countries are willing to be part of. And the, as Michael mentioned, you know, the strong reaction, you know, the first, you know, 60 countries and international organization represented at the highest political level in Paris for the forum is a sure sign that it has an attractiveness. And by the way, I can announce it because in fact it's already news, you know, the EU will have each year and probably under each presidency an event on the EU Indo-Pacific strategy. We want to push this very actively with all the relevant partners, interested partners, the like-minded partners. So this is an important element. You know, it is a policy of open end. It's a policy based on project. It's a policy based on actual means, huge means, which are open. And obviously Australia can play a role there. If it so wishes, it is, at the end of the day, the decision of Australia and the sovereign decision of its people.
And I think we're all being very clear, but also very, very diplomatic about, I guess, the role of Australia in the region and the role of the different inclusive mechanisms for coping with regional challenges. There's also the question, of course, of exclusive mechanisms of countries in the region or in the region or with stakes in the region building other diplomatic arrangements to help cope from their perspective with the security challenges. And so the Quad has been a major part of the Indo-Pacific diplomatic landscape in recent years. Of course, last year, the AUKUS deal with Australia, Britain and the United States attracted a lot of controversy, seen, of course, as an exclusive arrangement and for the role that it will play. The US alliances, the various alliances bilaterally and other arrangements, again, look more exclusive than inclusive. I think one of the questions a lot of us as observers are dealing with is how do we reconcile the inclusive approaches to regional cooperation in the Indo-Pacific and the more exclusive arrangements, however their participants may feel that they're justified in terms of balancing Chinese power. How do we reconcile these two? I wonder if either of you could comment on that. I might go to you, Michael.
Well, we have decided for our Indo-Pacific strategy to be it an inclusive approach. We invite all countries of the region to be part of that. We've outlined what our engagement with this region would be and what our vision for this region would be. And every country who shares that vision and is prepared to work with it on that basis is invited to join. And that's the modus operandi that we do have in Europe. It has worked in Europe, and therefore we bring it also to this region. It is for other organizations and fora to define how their exclusiveness or inclusiveness will be handled, it's not for us to comment on that. But for us at the European level, we have to obviously see how our bilateral partnerships with some of the important countries of that region overlaps and converges with what we want to achieve with a broader-based Indo-Pacific strategy. And that, indeed, is a task that we have to fulfill. Jean-Pierre mentioned the fact that we now set up annual summits. We have now an envoy for the Indo-Pacific. We set up internal systems in our foreign ministries and other ministries and organizations to deal with this. So we create a base and a platform to drive that debate forward. And our vision, of course, for a region would be to make it as inclusive as possible, because ultimately that creates stability.
Well, would you like to add to that, Jean-Pierre?
I think Michael has made the point very clearly. We are for cooperation and not for confrontation. This is a starting base, because this is exactly what we we've built in Europe, we try to expand it with partners, but on an equal basis. So we have respect for our partners also. At the same time, we are not blind. We've seen now very much aware of the geopolitical dynamics at play in the region. And so let's be frank also, there is no naivety on our side. But to summarize, instead of wondering what we would do in case of dramatic change in deterioration in the region, we think that it is much better to focus immediately without waiting on what we should do to avoid such an outcome. And this is exactly what the EU and its member states is proposing to the region. Let's bid on communalities. Let's bid as a matter of principle on the international rule-based order and the recognized principle of the international order of transparency, of mutual respect, of sovereignty, of refusal of use of force to settle disputes. And for that, we propose projects. We proposed to be co-funding or funding, with all like-minded partners, the projects that matters for the future of the regions. And once again, this very strong emphasis on climate change. We were discussing the role of Australia. The EU is looking for, and France in particular, but we're looking for a very strong role of that we could play together with Australia in this region, the Pacific Island states. Those are states which survival, mere survival, might be put in jeopardy in only some years' time if we are not listening to their plea for more climate action. Not only mitigation, but also, actual measures at the world scene to really embark the international community in this respect. And all the other elements which are ensuring for those countries, as many other countries largely populated in the region, human social stability and offering also an alternative eventually to other models and choices, which would be more unilateral or not based on rules and principles of transparency. So this is what it is at the core of this EU strategy, and this is what we want to promote. And if we can promote it actively with a strong Australian participation, with a strong support, understanding of Australia, we would be very happy for that. And the same way, we will be ready to work with all the partners in Asia based on the principle of the centrality of ASEAN, to make this happen. We need to defy the logic of the blocks. We need to be inclusive, at least to propose efficiently to be inclusive and to avoid any shift. But once again, we are not naive.
Thank you for that, Jean-Pierre. And I think that's You very eloquently preempted my last question, which I will actually direct back to Michael, if I may, and that's really about the role of China in the region. So I think we've heard again a very, very strong enunciation of principles of sovereignty, of non-coercion, of human development, of human rights, human dignity, and of course countering climate change. And I think all of those I would like to imagine are endorsed by a wide range of countries in the Indo-Pacific stakeholders in this region as well. That also speaks to the global challenge, including the way it's manifested with Russian aggression in Europe in defending sovereignty, defending the very basic principles of the UN Charter. Those of us who watch the strategic situation in the Indo-Pacific are concerned about how it could well deteriorate. We worry, of course, as I'm sure European partners do, of the possibility of conflict in the region, of conflict across the Taiwan Strait, of greater coercion, a whole lot of conflict possibilities, many of which have China as a common factor. Watching this region and watching how this strategic situation could deteriorate in the future, do you see ways in which the European approach could adjust or could change if Asia does move to a more confrontational position?
Well, what we've said at the outset when we defined our Indo-Pacific strategy was that We have to bring this in line and base it on our individual cooperation with key countries of the region. And we had a China policy to start with. In that China policy, we've shown that Europe has reacted to a shift in China's emphasis. We define our policy with China differently from the time when I was posted to Beijing. We will move forward by reviewing our relationship with China. And of course, you mentioned one of the key questions that is before the government of that country at this very point in time. We see a war in Europe, and there's no other word about it. Every country is now asked to take a stand on that. Do we accept that? Do we allow that? Do we support this or not? Reactions to that will in some ways influence how European governments, but also European people, will look to our relationship with key partners here. And this will define in some ways also how much we can see that country as a partner going forward, if it responds or not to one of the real threats and challenges that we face, not only as Europeans, but as a world community. We shouldn't forget the world has condemned Russia on what it's doing. It very clearly did so in two resolutions recently. We want to make it clear to every country that its position on this issue is a defining factor, not the only one, but a defining factor. Our policies will react to that, and we review our partnerships as we go along.
Ambassador Tebow, any final thoughts?
You know, we there is no prejudice against China. We want China to be a partner, a cooperation partner. We recognize China as an economic competitor. But also we emphasize the fact that China is a systematic rival. And from this point of view, everything that Micah mentioned makes sense. We expect from partners of the EU that they are consistent and their words must not be hollow or empty, wishful thinking, statements. We have a situation which happens to be in Ukraine, but which is putting the world or whole world order, in jeopardy, possibly. The way each and individual country will react, not only taking into consideration its short-term interest, but also the interest of this rule-based order, will obviously affect the way we will be looking at each and every individual country. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, in the meanwhile, we want not to just wait and see. We want to act. And this is exactly the core of the EU Indo-Pacific strategy. We want that the EU here does contribute to this peaceful structuring of the region. We want that countries here have reliable international partners. We are ready not only to invest, to contribute, but also to involve with them in preserving, keeping, making those values, alive and being dominant for the future. And this is a very important thing which is happening at the same time here. But once again, both are interconnected. And you can count, I think the Australian public can count on the EU to be very active in the years to come further, to be willing to engage with Australia in all the areas where together with Australia, we can make a huge difference, especially here in the Pacific. And once again, I insist on climate change. There are major decisions still to be taken after Glasgow and by the end of this year. And we need collectively to make it a success. And we have concrete actions also to engage, because we need to showcase that there are choices. and that values matters and that values can make a difference for a free, open Indo-Pacific regions as we in huge majority wish.
So thank you, Ambassador. That's a compelling note to conclude our conversation on. I'm really looking forward to the National Security College hosting a forum with you very soon on the European, on the EU Indo-Pacific strategy. I think there are so many questions that our conversation both informs but also raises. It's been really illuminating for me. I particularly like the way that you've pointed to the multidimensional character of European engagement in the Indo-Pacific, the role, for example, of development, the role of principles, investment, and really, if you like, preparing the ground so that the risks of confrontation are diminished. Thank you very much for your time, Ambassador Pulch from the European Union and Ambassador Thébault from France, but representing the role of France in the EU presidency. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor.
Thanks a lot, Murray.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.